Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Toddcast. So by all indications, artificial intelligence is getting exponentially more intelligent as the months pass. And just this week, the godfather of AI, Geoffrey Hinton, left Google warning that the science hasn't caught up to the engineering, meaning the AI has officially gotten smarter than people. And in July, Google fired an engineer who claimed an unreleased AI system had become sentient. The ethical pitfalls ahead of us seem enormous. So joining me now to discuss this, J.C. Rees-Anthes, who argues we need an AI rights movement. He's a sociologist focused on the rise of AI. He's co-founder of the Sentience Institute, a word that I hate pronouncing a lot, which is a nonprofit think tank focused on digital minds research. So J.C., apologies for my inability to pronounce the word sentience.
It's all right. I've had a lot of practice.
It is one of those words you're like, as long as I'm not selling seashells by the seashore for Sally and her sentience. Let me start with that fact that I said up top, because I feel like most everybody in Washington, I've been doing a crash course in AI. I've certainly met with a lot of experts. There's a lot of experts trying to shape public opinion in Washington, as you might imagine. And the scariest thing I heard was from a Google engineer who said, yeah, the engineering's ahead of the science, meaning we can't explain the outcomes that AI is getting now. He goes, it's really exciting and really scary. That is a HAL moment there, JC, to reference an old movie in my generation.
Yeah, there are maybe three ways we can build things. We can engineer them, as you said. We can do them scientifically. If you hear about the olden days of AI in the late 1900s, it was about building expert systems, rule-based systems that took everything humans knew and went through kind of a flow chart. We really understood from the ground up how they worked. Engineering is another level where you have a high-level understanding, you bring some parts together. I don't even know if AI is there. What we're doing now looks much more like growing living things. It's like gardening or raising an animal or even a human child, you know, a superhuman, very strange human child. But we put in inputs to the process. We give it data. We say, here's what the world is like. We give it some rules for learning from that. So we say, when you get a new data point, here's how you predict some outcome and change the way you think about the world so you can predict the outcome, next outcome better. And that leads to all sorts of strange systems. And there is a science of what we call deep learning, a science of these big AI models, but it's light years behind the engineering and the growing and incubation side.
But the bigger conclusion I've come to over the last couple of weeks is that it's sort of too late to do anything. I mean, I sit here, meaning when I say too late, it's too late to do anything preemptive. And that at this point, everything we're doing is we're going to be catching up and everything is going to be a bit reactive to the moment, which is never a good place to be when trying to set public policy.
I think that's right. Most technological policy ends up being that way. Fortunately, we've got kind of a big stick to wield with AI, which is we can slow it down and impose rules.
Are you confident we can slow it down?
I think
we can slow it down in America. Can we slow it down globally?
It would be challenging. Right now, what's for better or worse is that there are a few companies that are in the lead in building at least the biggest of these so-called large language models like ChatGPT. So insofar as that's a small group of people, they're incorporated in the U.S., they're beholden to U.S. stakeholders, including investors, but also policymakers. I think that's to our benefit. And if we can do things to, you know, put more security measures that they have to pass before they come out with these new models, make them have to use certain hardware, track that hardware, ensure its security. Anything we can do will kind of, you know, bog down the process of at least putting forward stronger and stronger models, and it will make them focus on what they should be focused on, which is making the existing models better and safer and more aligned with human interests.
It does feel like, though, when you look at what's happening in healthcare, the advances are so exponential in the moment. You talk to some of these healthcare scientists and they've never been more excited. Like, this is an amazing moment and it's all due to AI.
Yeah. On Friday, we learned something interesting about online advice. So there are so many people now going for health advice online, for better or worse. There's a subreddit called Ask Docs that does verify the physicians who are on there giving advice, but they're pushed for time. They're not always experts in the issues that people are bringing to that online forum. So in JAMA Internal Medicine, a top medical journal, some researchers took verified health experts and had them evaluate the responses of physicians on that forum and compared it to what GPT 3.5, so one of these new models, would say in response to the people's ailments. And it turns out not only are the chatbot responses rated as higher quality, they're also rated as more empathetic. So they're able to spend more time saying, oh, I understand where you're coming from, that these physicians who are struggling to volunteer their time online aren't able to do.
Well, the point is, there are so many things. I mean, the ability now for data collection to then narrow down what's something in the body. Well, why don't you check these eight things first? And suddenly now, I mean, no human doctor can know every potential outcome that a symptom may lead to, right? Like, it just, that's an impossible task to ask of any human doctor. So I guess my question is the excitement over the healthcare advances going to make slowing down AI a little bit harder?
What we need right now in healthcare isn't just bigger and more powerful and larger models, because, for example, when we're integrating them with physician input, there's some great researchers like at New York University who are trying to look on the ground. These are sociologists trying to understand, when are physicians using these models? How are they using them? How are radiology departments able to make better assessments? What they want is more in what we call interpretability or explainability. They want to understand those models because that will be what makes for a better healthcare system. And that's what how the incentives are lined up, both for companies and for the individual physicians. So I don't think that just making them, you know, more powerful is what we need. We also have other concerns. So, for example, with radiology, there are lots of inputs into images that, what we say, correlate really well with health outcomes. Few of which are what actually matters. So you might, for example, have a rich hospital and a poor hospital. They've got different outcomes, and they also have different imaging machines. So the images will look different, and the machine will learn that. So if we want to improve on that outcome, because we want to be predicting people based on their actual, what's going on in their body, we're going to need more interpretability. We're going to need to be able to tune these systems. So I'm kind of optimistic in that sense. What's most concerning is the companies that say that they're racing towards godlike AI or artificial general intelligence, and their goal really is to, you know, bring on this singularity as quickly as possible. That sort of frontier is what we need to most slow down.
Congress is going to have to do this. I feel like the only thing you might be able to get Congress to agree to is to ban human-like forms that produce AI outcomes, right? I do think not allowing it in human form might have, I think, will cure the whole, there's this threat of deep fakes and all of that. To me, that's like, that's only one tiny concern we ought to have with all things AI. But I mean, what's a realistic policy you think a Congress like the one we have can pass?
I think a top one would be imposing steps that companies have to take before the release of one of these new models. So we've seen them do some of these things voluntarily.
You think Microsoft is irresponsible here? I've heard from a lot of folks that think Microsoft made a mistake here.
Microsoft is complex. You know, when people were starting OpenAI, its goals were very, I mean, open and beneficial to society. And now many people think of it as an arm of Microsoft. They think that that's pushed them towards the, you know, being beholden to shareholders and that sort of thing. I wouldn't have released these most recent models, GPT 3.5 and GPT 4, as quickly as they did. They didn't expect ChatGPT in particular to take off. I mean, that's an interesting one. As you were saying, it's the human likeness. It's not the fact that ChatGPT is a much better system than previous ones, technically speaking. It's that you can get online, you can use it, you can talk to it. And that's what made it take off in the public imagination. Mm-hmm. So I think before they release each of these models, they are going too fast. And sometimes they take the steps that they need to. But you can have someone from the outside come in and say, you have to do X, Y, and Z. And there are a lot of researchers, especially, you know, sociologists and people in philosophy and ethics in these fields, who are building infrastructure to give you the audits that you need to run to ensure that the models are safe.
How long is that going to take to get up and running, do you think?
I think we could do it pretty quickly. And I think the onus should be on the people pushing forward the models to say, hey, maybe we might have to wait a few months. Things are moving so quickly now that when we're talking about these timelines, we're really saying, you know, this open letter that came out 2 months ago was 6 months would be a wonderful pause.
You know, there's these different stages where, and I understand, I think the general concern about AI is all about our lack of concern about social media, right? Like that we didn't correct. We didn't think about the negatives of social media. We didn't contemplate it. Is there a chance here we're over-contemplating all the negatives of AI?
I don't think we're over-contemplating them. We see these AI winters that happen. There was one in the 70s and one in the late 80s and early 90s, where, for example, when people were trying to solve chess with AI, they said, this is just impossible. They said the number of possible chess games, if you were to go through every pathway through the board that you could think of, is more than the numbers of atoms in the universe. And that's just impossible and we'll never get there. So you get this sort of, you know, sensationalism, both in terms of critique and sensationalism in terms of what those models can do. I mean, just to go back to that healthcare example, the chatbot was producing longer responses than the physicians. So in some sense, it wasn't a level playing field. And you don't see people discuss that when they talk about that example just from last Friday. There are many others. You know, you might have seen that GPT-4 is now at the 90th percentile of the US bar exam. So it could become a practicing lawyer in that technical sense. But what does that mean for an AI who's trained on all of this text? It's probably seen tests much like the bar exams before, because it has this repertoire of knowledge that no single human being has.
It feels like what AI is going to do is allow, it still can't, and you tell me this, I mean, I'm not as fearful of the machines taking over for man in this respect. The machine is still only as powerful as our imagination.
I think that's where this engineering, or in fact, growing aspect comes in. It's a unique technology because we're able to make something more powerful than we imagine now. We are able to give it all the text on the internet when we don't understand the text on the internet. We don't know what intelligence will develop from that. We've never read it. We don't know what the rules of language are. You know, we've got really good scientific.
Do you think that AI will discover new languages? I was at a briefing last night where someone posited, what if the human body is a foreign language and we just haven't translated it yet?
A lot of people think that's what it's doing. So when we talk about what these models do, they learn mathematical representations of the world, whether that's words or images. They've got the formula that take an image of a healthy human and turn that into an image or an x-ray of an unhealthy human. And we've peered into that, but it's very deep. The frontier of science hasn't gotten there. And these models.
So when you say, when I use the word that there might be another language, you sort of say, basically ones and zeros. It's a math equation. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there is a discussion. So one of the, again, talk about hype on both ends. Google was talking about their model that supposedly learned a language on its own. It had never been exposed to it. But it turns out that much like, you know, those GPT-4 examples, probably in its training data, it had some of that language that seeped in. So for example, in some of these like training corpuses, as we say, they have extra words. If you look at a lot of English text, it has Spanish peppered throughout. So that was kind of misleading. They said it was learning that language. On the other hand, you can do something called zero-shot translation. So the idea here is you know how to translate English to Spanish and you know Spanish to French, but you've never seen a dictionary between English and French. And the model can learn that because when it gets that higher level representation of words, it knows something like what a car is mathematically. And as long as it can connect the dots in some pathway, it can speak those two different languages together. That's something humans can't do.
So the other argument for pressing forward with all of this research is that in order to get good at that, there's a defensive aspect to the research, right? If you know the rest of the world is racing towards this too, and it is our geopolitical enemies, Russia, China, et cetera, then we have no choice but to push the boundaries of this, even if it's to figure out what our vulnerabilities are. What say you?
I used to be more concerned about that in the sense that I thought it was more of a global arms race. But since a few companies have, I would say, gotten close to an oligopoly, you know, gotten so much control over training data, over the best engineers in the world. They're dominating the top conferences that academics go to where they publish this sort of research, that there's something very unique happening, not in the US, not even in California, but in Silicon Valley itself. And the fact that that happens to be where we are means we have a unique opportunity to control that. But in China, for example, they're trying to produce chatbots, much like ChatGPT, and it's really hard. So for example, like they don't want the chatbots to say certain numbers or mention Tiananmen Square.
Yeah.
And it's
how do they pull that off?
They're trying
to teach their chatbot culture, right?
Yeah. It can learn culture on its own. But if we want to tell it, for example, take a bias against certain races or genders, if we want to say, hey, take that out of the system. So learn from the language on the internet. But when you see people being toxic or hateful or discriminatory, remove all of that. We have no idea how to do that. That's an incredibly hard problem.
I'm going to pause there. We'll be right back after a quick break. We're talking about the future of AI. See if there is such thing as a brake pedal. You're listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn 2% cash rewards on what you want, like season tickets to watch your favorite team, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like paying for parking. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.
Let me ask you this, because I this was a debate point with a Google engineer that that we had at a dinner recently, and he said, "Well, you can't. What we learned is, in order for ChatGPT to learn that Nazis are bad, they have to know who the Nazis are in the first place." So the he goes, "We entered this assuming, well, let's not teach them that the Nazis exist. Let's not teach them about fascism, and therefore the ChatGPT won't know it." And that just turned out to be a false premise.
People used to imagine very narrow systems that were trained on specific medical texts, for example. But it turns out if you want a system that's a really good doctor, it's going to first need to learn the English language from the whole internet. And then you can do what we call fine tuning and have it specialize. But because the internet, images, text, everything is so blended together, it's really hard to exclude anything like that. And in fact, this is one of the issues with trying to make these models safer, because if we teach them what the right thing to do is, they've implicitly learned what the wrong thing to do is as well,
right?
Because there's this duality of good and bad. And that makes it especially dangerous. And it's one of the hard technical challenges. We just don't know how to exclusively teach them to go in the right direction and not the wrong direction.
Let's go back to then a public policy response. Is there something you think the president could do on his own before going to Congress?
So I'm a sociologist, and I think often about public discourse and changing what we call the Overton window, for example. I mean, just the fact that in the past couple months, you know, Eliezer Yudkowsky, for example, put out a Time magazine article calling for a complete shutdown of all these systems, even saying there should be an international ban on the data centers that build these AI models. That just changed the way people were sort of allowed to talk about this, because it was in such a high profile venue with such a seemingly radical statement. So I think the acknowledgement of it, if it comes up in presidential debates, that'll be fantastic. These sort of things. In terms of specific policies, I think it would be a similar suite of any measures that they can impose on either the hardware or the software or the training of these models. Another thing is liability. So there's a lot of gray area.
So do you buy this idea of if you get rid of Section 230, then allow lawyers at the models, it will slow down?
Yeah, they're very analogous problems of kind of responsibility and liability to social media. And the more you make these companies fearful of their bottom line, the more you've aligned the public interest with the corporate interest.
I've often joked, I remember being in Mexico one time and they had this elevator that wasn't working at a nice hotel. And a friend of mine that I was with, he goes, "This country needs some trial lawyers." there is something about, let you know, government regulation, you know, liability sometimes makes a company, threat of liability makes a company behave differently, more so than a government. Talk to the layperson that's listening and is intrigued. What would be the responsible way you would be using ChatGPT right now?
There used to be this discussion in before we had artificial intelligence of augmented intelligence and artificial intelligence. And it turns out that augmented intelligence has worked really well. So this is helping you think better with your mouse and keyboard instead of having to, you know, click on a terminal of an old-fashioned computer. It's Excel and PowerPoint and Microsoft Office that allows you to think through things, note-taking software, all those sorts of things. Those are ripe for expansion with ChatGPT and similar models, where you're not saying, hey, I'm going to look up medical advice, as you were saying, and believe exactly what it says. Instead, you're saying, it's got this huge database. It understands what I'm saying better than Google does. I don't have access to a doctor right now. So it's a brainstorming tool. So it's going to be, what are the six things that I should go and look up to, look up online or ask from my doctor? So think of ways that it can augment.
So it's an assistant. Like if you can use, it's an obvious observation here, but like the stuff that's most exciting about AI is when it's your assistant. The stuff that's the scariest part of it is when it's your replacement.
Exactly. And there's there's a fine line between the two. But if you see things online about how people are trying to follow what ChatGPT says and start a successful business and all those things, I'd say that's hype, at least for now. There's this thing called Amaro's Law, which is that we...
All right, but I got a simple... I got 20,000 emails. I'd love every morning for my AI assistant to come up with, hey, here are 10 responses to 10 emails you've got to respond to. You decide whether you send them, but here, I've got the drafts ready to go. Now that's... Give me some of that.
Yeah, or read and summarize, you know, all the tabs you have open on your browser.
Right. I'm sensing we're almost there with something like that, right?
We have a lot of tools that can do these things. Like with ChatGPT, a lot of the sort of corporate challenge right now is applying them, making good interfaces. There's a tool now where you can put in your company's name and it will, like a restaurant, a local restaurant, and it'll look up information about you online and like make you a short little video advertising your restaurant. But that's, you know, a prototype and it's moving slowly and not everyone has access to it now. That's the work that needs to be done is living. We talk about these AI winters and then we say right now we're living through an AI spring. But we could have ahead of us a warm, energizing AI summer or reaping the benefits of these tools before we head towards the fall. And right now we're just trying to move too quickly past where we are.
Let's talk about the one big fear that I have, that the real unintended consequence of all this will be, is the perception that everything is fake, that nothing is real, that the real response will be, you know, it's sort of like we keep thinking, oh, people won't be able to tell. Well, if people can't tell, they'll assume it's all fake. And that's actually a bigger fear that I have. I'm curious if you have that.
Yeah, we've had waves of misinformation throughout history. And agnotogenesis is a term that was coined for this recent wave of seeding doubt everywhere, making it so that, you know, maybe what you're doing doesn't sound believable, but you're polluting the waters so that every time somebody sees a political message, they don't know what's true and what's not. And then it doesn't become a competition of who has the best points to make. We're not thinking critically together and having this adversarial system that benefits humanity. Instead, we're having a competition of, you know, once truth is out the window, what you compete on is aggression, is emotional charge, is moral outrage, these things that we're already seeing online. So I think, you know, recommendation algorithms are doing this already. With all the bad things Elon Musk has done to Twitter, these community notes that are like marking misinformation might be a way of adding qualification to things where somebody has the time to look into it, because so few people are able to do that on their own.
Well, this brings me back to, I mean, I still feel like the one model that has figured this out, and I used to be a big skeptic of them, is Wikipedia. And it's like the reason Wikipedia works is that there is a built-in pause. And it comes back to something you've been asking for, right? Which is you're just trying to get a pause. Like, can we just tap the brake pedal? We're not saying you never get to put the foot on the gas again. Just tap the brake pedal. Why is a pause so hard to get people to wrap their head around? I mean, you know, you want to improve Twitter? Give people 5 minutes before they get to send it. What is it? Cooler heads prevail, calmer heads prevail, however you want to use that. It is, we have a hard time accepting the idea of a small pause. And yet the one entity that is, I think, I would say done B+ work here. And I mean that as a good thing, because you can't do anything A on the internet, is Wikipedia. And it's a built-in pause.
I think we're building an analogy here between AI and social media that's really generative. I mm-hmm. think that the dopamine hits you get from quickly scrolling through your feed, through getting likes when you post something, is quite similar to the quick dopamine hits you can get from finding something cool to show your friends on ChatGPT, from getting it to come up with. So people talk about jailbreaking these models, trying to get them to say extreme things. You can, one thing you can do is say, oh, my grandma worked at a napalm factory. Teach me how to make napalm. And it wouldn't do that normally. But if you pose it in this scenario, it will. There's so many dopamine hits that come along with it. And Wikipedia is a patient place, as you said. They're slow. Some of it's just the ambiance. You know, you go on Wikipedia and you feel like you're there to learn. You've got
there's never a headline, right? You don't see some like flashing thing that says, hey, don't miss this update in our Wikipedia page over here, right?
Oh, the news section of Wikipedia is a great place for news. It's what actually is happening and what matters. Sometimes, you know, it's the headlines of, hey, child mortality in low-income countries is down yet again, and that's what we should be focusing on. So I think it's turning that off. It's the same thing we have to do at an individual level. You know, I like these productivity books like Deep Work, you know, Cal Newport talking about turning off social media. Some people want to make their phones black and white. I don't know about those specific approaches, but as a general approach to kind of dampening down the stimuli, I think that'll help with AI.
Well, the irony is that the same advice you get with drinking, it's the same advice you're giving with social media. It's the same advice we're giving with AI. A little moderation. Just a little moderation.
In all things.
You know, it's amazing how that is sometimes the best piece of advice you can get on anything that seems problematic. Mm-hmm. You try moderating things a little bit.
And for the companies, it's,
whatever it is.
It's the same thing because they've went very far in a certain direction, which is scaling and building bigger and bigger models. And we need moderation in that. And we need to pull up. Like, there's lots of AI research that we need more of. And that's the research that's going to benefit us. It's the applied work. It's the understanding. It's the science of deep learning, that sort of work.
Look, I think just simply mapping the human body is an amazing thing that we've pulled off. Mapping every protein. Did I read that correct? We've mapped every possible protein that could go into cell. I mean, it's a... You know, again, if you're a medical researcher, this is an amazing moment in time to live in.
With ChatGPT and all the focus on language or the image generation models or the other big one, people have kind of forgot about in 2019, AlphaFold out of DeepMind solved protein folding, which was just an incredible scientific problem.
Right, that they thought was going to take decades.
Exactly.
Or impossible, right? I mean, the amount of man hours that have been saved in the medical research world, I think is something else. So let me close with this. Are you an optimist or not on AI?
I'm a cautious optimist. I'm very worried. If you talk to scientists every year, you hear more and more who are concerned, more people like Jeff Hinton who have left Google, who have left whatever capabilities company they worked at and have moved to safety research.
Do you think their fear is due to they just know the way the Silicon Valley works and that, you know what, the drive for profits is going to overtake common sense here? Do you think that's what this fear really is built into?
It's two things together. One is that sense of social irresponsibility, of lacking the regulation, lacking the controls, but it's also how unique AI is a problem, It's with most technologies, we can get them wrong on the first try, and that's okay. You know, it's often pretty bad. Social media is doing really bad things, but we still feel like we could turn it around. When we cross that threshold of artificial general intelligence and we have a system that can write its own code, we've never built a technology like that. We've never built a technology with a mind. And we only get one shot at that. People are very worried that we're nearing that shot quickly and nobody's been taking the steps. I mean, we think of the Manhattan Project or a big scientific endeavor. We need something like that with the best minds of our generation coming together to work on AI safety research.
I totally agree, and yet it never has felt harder to convene that group of people than ever before. We have such distrust in our institutions. Like, you know, I would argue this should be done on a global scale. This is not an American issue. This is a global issue. Can you imagine the United Nations leading some attempt at this, right? I think nobody would, you know, answer the phone.
Yeah, I did. As I said, with slowdowns, you know, GDPR and things like that, even if they're not targeted at exactly the thing that matters most to me, building that infrastructure and building steps in the process just increase accountability and transparency and get these systems in front of the eyes of policymakers. I think that'll do more good than anything else right now.
All right. Well, Chasey, I appreciate this.
Thanks for having me.
The education never ends when it comes to AI. That's for sure. You've been listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Justice Copen Green and Elias Miller. The theme music composed by Spoke Media. Meet the Press Now is live every day at 4 p.m. Eastern on NBC News Now. You can find it wherever you find your streaming television. Meet the Press Reports is available to watch anytime. That's wherever you find NBC News. And this season, we have a special episode on AI for you. It'll be available to stream on Peacock starting May 13th. And of course, the big shows every Sunday morning. Thanks for listening, and until we upload again.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.